Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Today, it's the local news roundup. This week, City Council asked City Manager Marcus Jones to find a way to reduce his recommended tax hike of 1.5 cents. Where might that be headed? And what about Mecklenburg County's tax increase? In Cornelius, jury selection started in the case of Christopher Palmiter. Palmiter is the stepfather of Madalena Kojikari, the 11-year-old girl who disappeared in November 2022 and has not been heard from since. Kojikari's mother, Diana, left jail this week after serving 17 months for failure to report her daughter's disappearance. And Mecklenburg County Commissioner-elect Yvette Townsend Ingram's DWI arrest on May 1st surfaced this week as WBTV broke the news of police finding Townsend Ingram in her car with a bottle of wine. And the Coca-Cola 600 at Charlotte Motor Speedway returned Sunday, with former President Donald Trump expected to attend. Here to discuss these stories and more is our panel of reporters from the Charlotte Observer. Mary Ramsey is their local government accountability reporter. Easy for me to say. And Mary C. Curtis is a columnist at rollcall.com, host of the podcast Equal Time, and a contributor to the new book, We Refuse to Be Silent, Women's Voices on Justice for Black Men. Also here is Eli Portillo. He is senior editor of WFAE News. And last but not least, Alex Sands is a reporter at Axios Charlotte. Good morning to you all.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, let's start with the city budget. On May 6th, City Manager Marcus Jones, as you all know, recommended a $4.2 billion budget for the fiscal year that starts July 1st, and that included a 1.5-cent tax increase, which would cost the median homeowner $54 more per year. On Monday, City Council voted 8-3 for Jones and his staff to look for ways to lower the tax increase. Here is Republican Tark Bakari pleading with his colleagues to make cuts, a move he believes is necessary to show the Republican Majority General Assembly that Charlotte can keep taxes low and convince the General Assembly to allow a 1-cent sales tax increase next year to fund transit.
We're going to significantly hurt ourselves in our ability to make the case that Charlotte is all in on the sales tax.
So, Mary Ramsey, what was the manager's reaction to Monday night?
Yeah, didn't really get much of a reaction in the room. That being said, Marcus Jones has said before when he introduced his budget that he had foreshadowed this tax increase previously, that it was something that was the city was able to stave off in the past years. This is technically the first increase in 5 years. Although it's worth noting that a lot of people still paid more last year because of revaluation and rising property values. That being said, and that the basically that the time had come, that this was inevitable in order to keep up city services. But we'll see heading into next week and straw votes on Thursday whether him, Marcus Jones, and city staff were able to find anywhere to nip and tuck.
Yeah, I'm curious, Eli, as you know, there is not much time. Mary just mentioned the meeting next week, and then you have the vote June 10th. And when you think about this, it's so much tied into employee pay. It's tied a lot into economic mobility, which we have talked about over and over for the last 5 years in Charlotte. So how much wiggle room is there, do you think, to bring this tax increase down?
Well, you know, there is definitely some appetite to do that among city council because 8 of them voted for asking to see if there are any cuts. But, you know, out of this 1.5-cent property tax increase, 9/10 of a cent there would go to employee raises and public safety workers, you know, police, fire, 911 call center operators, hiring more of them. So, you know, it's really hard to imagine that they're going to trim that. A smaller portion would go towards arts and culture funding. You know, they might take a bite there. But, you know, I think that there's not really any thought that the property tax increase is going to be completely negated. One aspect I thought was interesting was, you know, Tark Bakari tying this directly to the transit sales tax possibility and whether the legislature might go for that. we haven't seen any direct, you know, any signaling from the legislature of, hey, you keep your property tax rate low, we'll consider this sales tax. So I think, you know, a lot would have to happen in the next week for that tie-in to be made.
Mary C., I'm curious what you think about political risk here. Is it more with the cuts or is it more with the raising taxes?
Well, you saw also Tariq Bakari talk about the effect of what's going to happen with how Raleigh views Charlotte. And do we want to be seen as some folks who are not responsible and are not mindful about things like taxes? And so it's course of, you know, it's always that balance between the need and the taxes and how that's going to be received.
Eli, what do you think? You were talking about, you know, the areas where you might see some nip and tuck. What about the expanded bond package? I think it's $400 million that the city manager has talked about. Would that be an area that could be touched, do you think?
Well, you know, some of this, the city's budget, of course, goes towards servicing those bonds. So bonds are a little like taking a loan or putting something on a credit card. You borrow the money and then you have to pay it back. So if you borrow less money, you have less to pay back in the future. What's interesting about this is the city manager has said that he's pulled forward some of the borrowing that they were planning to do in future years. So borrowing more now to spend more on immediate needs. It's you know, largely going towards affordable housing subsidies for new construction and transportation, you know, stuff like sidewalks, gaps, and constructing new ways of getting around where the city really has some significant holes. So, you know, what the city manager has said is, hey, these are urgent needs. We need to pull this borrowing forward and we need to increase our bond package now because we've got these needs right now. I suppose it's possible the city could say, maybe those needs can wait a few years so we have a smaller property tax increase. But I think most of what the city has signaled around, city council has signaled around affordable housing and transportation needs is that they want to get some bigger efforts like those $100 million affordable housing bonds moving now.
It's kind of funny that Tariq is saying that we shouldn't increase property taxes because we want to get the sales tax for transportation, because the city manager is saying we should have this $400 million bond so that we can show that we're taking this effort seriously and that we're putting money into transportation and we want to move this stuff forward and we want to get a jump start. So it's kind of like a conflicting mission here.
And to your point, Alex, the other thing that jumped out at me is as council was talking about lowering this tax increase, it seemed like half of them were suggesting additional spending at the same meeting. So I'm not sure how those two things work out.
I would go so far as to say more than half. Tariq Bakari, for example, suggested even more spending on public safety, wanting to buy some additional equipment in the wake of the fatal shooting on Galway Drive a couple of weeks ago. There were requests to add more organizations to that arts funding that Eli mentioned, things like that. Pretty much everybody had stuff they wanted added. Now, not all of that got enough support to move on to next week's meeting, but there were definitely more adds proposed in addition to the same council member saying we should also trim the tax cut or the tax increase.
Mary C. Yeah.
And at issue in all of this is always, of course, the salaries for the lower paid workers. We talk about housing costs, affordable housing. And I mean, they're always there at the meetings as well saying, hey, we do this work. We need more workers in a growing city and we need to be more fairly compensated in a city in which the costs are rising for things like housing. Raising their voices.
Yeah. Along those lines, city council members aren't the only ones with second thoughts on a tax increase. Last week, County Manager Dina DiIorio presented her $2.5 billion budget, including a 1.5 cent property tax increase. Dina DiIorio was on this program, and she told Mike Collins this week why a tax hike is needed.
Well, I think there's two, well, really one big factor, I would say, and Adrian can give you some additional details, but I think it's really our investment in people. I think if you look at, you know, the cost of increased compensation for employees, that is a big chunk of what's rising in our costs. In addition to that, You know, we gave a significant allocation to Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, but the vast majority of that, about 65% of that increase, was also investments in people. And so, you know, we all know how hard it's been to recruit and retain staff, and we have to have competitive salaries, competitive benefits, in order for us to be able to get the resources that we need in terms of human capital to provide services. So I think that is one of the biggest drivers in this year's budget.
On Wednesday, County Commissioner Susan Rodriguez McDowell asked whether the county could put off a half cent of the 1.5 cent property tax increase for a year and cover the balance this year with reserve funds.
Because I just have always felt that when we're sitting on so much fund balance, it doesn't feel right to raise taxes.
But her fellow Commissioner Elaine Powell said that the county needs to raise revenue to pay for services, especially since state funds don't cover some costs for schools and local courts.
None of us want to increase taxes, but we have more than 1 million people living here where we have to meet the needs.
So in response, DiIorio said commissioners can, are you ready for this? Consider splitting the tax increase over multiple years at, yes, their budget straw session next week. So I'm going to start with you, Mary Ramsey. How much of an appetite is there for actually lowering this tax increase?
Yeah, so obviously Commissioner Rodriguez McDowell did bring it up. Commissioner Laura Meyer said it was something she would also be open to hearing more about. That being said, you know, with the county's budget increase, 1 cent of it was already kind of baked in, tied to some past budget. So it's really only that second half cent that's in play. As you mentioned, Commissioner Rodriguez McDowell suggested using some funds from what's colloquially referred to as the rainy day fund to cover this. DINA's budget already includes using a pretty significant chunk of that reserve. That being said,
$100 million or something like that?
Yes, if memory serves, that's correct. So that's something that's kind of already being tapped into.
And I should mention, while that plays out, this is going back to what Eli mentioned with the city, county commissioners on Thursday heard from citizens in a public budget hearing, and many of those citizens who spoke want to add to the $2.5 billion budget to support arts and culture. Here's Terry White, CEO of the Charlotte Museum of History.
However, we make these improvements at the bottom of a hole that decades of neglect and divestment have left us in.
So again, we're in this quandary of wanting to lower the property tax increase, but at the same time, more spending being sought. So where does this wind up, Eli? What's the answer, you think, in 2 weeks?
Well, I think what's a little different about the city and the county situations is that the city, what Tariq Bakari has requested and what the city council voted to ask the manager to do is to actually come up with a budget that trims some spending to lower that tax increase. The county suggestion that they're looking at is to keep the spending the same, but just to pull more from the rainy day fund to cover it for a year instead of taxes, tax increase. The full tax increase. Keep in mind that the county also has tax increases already planned for future years to cover the $2.5 billion CMS bond. So there are property tax increases coming no matter what happens for the county. What's different is they're just kind of debating, should we pull more from the rainy day fund now and put off the pain a little bit?
And Mary R., you're going to be the scorekeeper, making sure. So both of these budget straw sessions are next week for city and county, and then June 4th and June 10th, respectively, for county and city budget votes. Is that
correct?
Right?
Yes. Straw votes are set for Thursday for both days, so it'll be one to watch.
There we go. This is one to listen to. So stay with us. We're right here on the local news roundup. Much more to discuss when we come back on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. It's Friday, and this is the local news roundup. We are continuing our conversation with Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call, Eli Portillo from WFAE, Alex Sands from Axios Charlotte, and Mary Ramsey of the Charlotte Observer. But before we get back to our panel, we're going to check in with another friend of the program, WSOC crime reporter Hunter Sines. Hunter, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. So as I mentioned earlier in the show, a lot of developments this week in the case of Madalena Kojikari, which is a case that I think you've been following for some time, and you were at the courthouse this week. So let's try and sort some of this out. First of all, Madalena Kojikari was the 11-year-old girl who disappeared in November 2022. Her mother, Diana Kojikari, was released from jail this week after pleading guilty to a charge of not reporting her child missing. And her husband and Madalena's stepfather, Christopher Palmiter, faces the same charge in a court case that began this week. I'm not even going to try to sort out any more details in these complexities. So tell us where things stand now and what's coming next.
Sure. So all of that is correct, Eric, of course. But Diana Kojikari, Madalena's mother, actually pleaded guilty. She changed her plea this week to guilty. She was released from jail because she technically had served the maximum sentence that she could have served for that charge. She was let out of jail. We, of course, questioned her as much as we could. The only thing that she would say is when asked if she thinks her daughter is safe, she said, "I hope she is safe." And that is all she told reporters walking out of the Mecklenburg County Jail. So I'm going to pause with that case, then pick up at the same case. Madalena's stepfather is charged, like you said, with the same charge. He pled not guilty, and so this is now going to trial. He got released from jail or bonded out a few months ago, so this has been brewing for some time. At first, there were a couple of motions from his defense attorney to continue this case after some new evidence came about. That was denied, so we have been in jury selection. We are going on day three of that right now.
And are they close on jury selection?
They are. They have to choose one more and two alternates. Hopefully that will get done by this morning. I think the hope here is, of course, with the holiday coming on Monday, is to be as efficient as possible with time. The judge has already said that he forecasts that this will go no later than the end of next week. So it'll be a pretty quick trial. The prosecutor said that he believes jury selection will actually take longer than the evidence being presented itself.
And any word on what you reported, you being WSOC, reported that there is not an extradition treaty between Moldova, where the biological mother is from, and the United States, and the judge has said that she's likely to be deported. So how much concern is there around that?
I think there is some concern because right now we don't know where Madalena is. That's still an ongoing investigation. So the concern is once we find out what has happened to this little girl, is there a way that her mother could technically either be deported back by law or fly back herself now that she is out and free and has served the time that she needed, and then face never having to be forced to come back to face anything else in the future should this case unravel in a very poor way, let's just say. So there are some concerns in that regard. That the big thing here is the big if, because we're going on now 2 years of not knowing the end of this case because Madalena is still missing.
And last question for you, Hunter, just for people who may have lost track, to remind them, beyond the disappearance, the crux of what we're talking about is that this little girl disappeared, and for 3 weeks, the stepmother and the mother didn't report it, didn't say anything to anyone until the school asked, correct?
Correct. That is what the police and prosecutors are claiming, that it went beyond the 24 hours that a parent or guardian is obligated to report a missing child after not having contact or knowing their whereabouts under state law. So prosecutors say it went far beyond that. this case, Eric, it's good to point out, this is not a case that is dealing with where Madalena is. This is just a case on the failure to report her as missing. I don't think we're going to hear, we may hear some, but I don't think we're going to hear a lot of the investigation. They still want to protect that at all cost, according to the prosecutor, of where Madalena is.
And of course, I lied to you. I said that was the last question, but your answer prompted. I just want to make sure. Diana Kojikari, biological mother, when she pled guilty this week, she pled guilty to not reporting the disappearance.
Correct.
Got it. All right. I'm sure we will be talking a lot more about this, and I appreciate you joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Have a nice weekend. Hunter Sines from WSOC. Okay, now we're going to whiplash back to the county and the budget for one final note, which is an interesting aspect of this budget discussion has been Dina DiOrio's endorsement of the school system's full funding request. Here's how she explained that decision on this program.
I really think that there's a lot more transparency in terms of how county funding will be used, and that was a big driver for me. You know, I think in prior years before that, there wasn't a tremendous amount of transparency about how county funding would be used. And then there was not a lot of transparency or accountability how county funding was used. And so this last couple of years with Superintendent Hill, you know, putting together her budgets, there's just a lot more of that, which I think gives me a lot more comfort about how county dollars will be used.
Eli, I have one question for you. Did you ever think that you would hear the county manager speaking about a CMS budget request in that manner?
No. And you know, this is the second year in a row that the county is fulfilling CMS's full request. In years past, budget cycles past, it's always been kind of just attritional warfare between the two of them, with CMS requesting more and the county giving less, and a lot of back and forth about that. You know, even mediation and other measures. So it's it really speaks to a change in the working relationship between them. And, you know, I think is a big contrast to the previous outright distrust that we've seen between these two governing bodies.
Another story. Go ahead, Mary.
Ironic that we are talking about support for the public schools. And I know we'll talk about this a little later when there are other forces that are saying, we don't believe in the public schools. We'd rather give money to private school vouchers. To be continued.
Mary C. Curtis gets the award for teaser for what's coming up on the roundup. We had another county government story this week with the news that Yvette Townsend Ingram, who beat out incumbent Pat Cotham for the third and final at-large seat on the county commissioner's board in March, was arrested May 1st on DWI charges. Mary Ramsey, what happened and how is Yvette Townsend Ingram explaining her arrest?
Yes, so she was arrested by Belmont police at a park in Belmont on the night of May 1st. She was charged with driving while intoxicated and an open container violation. She was found asleep in her car with a bottle of wine. I spoke to Yvette Townsend Ingram. She expressed remorse for her actions. She said that she was not in a good mental state at the time. She was dealing with the death of a sibling and losing her job. They say that she was in her car, claims that the car was parked at the time, but that she had left the car running in order to keep the air conditioning on, was drinking and fell asleep and then was taken into custody. So she expressed remorse and said she'll apologizes to her constituents and hopes that this will help her better understand the importance of funding mental health care that's provided by the county.
And because there are no Republican candidates in the at-large races, she is a lock to become a commissioner this fall. Any impact from this on her being sworn in?
So far as I know of, no.
All right. In Raleigh this week, we had a new wrinkle in the effort by the General Assembly to increase penalties for people wearing masks when they commit a crime or block a road while protesting. So the Senate passed a bill to do that, but the measure also wiped away an exemption to wear masks for health reasons. And before the House voted against the bill this week, multiple Republicans said they want the public health exception to remain in state law. Speaker Tim Moore says he wants legislation that targets people breaking the law.
You shouldn't be able to conceal your identity to engage in criminal conduct. The question is striking that balance to make sure that it doesn't go so far that you are limiting the ability of someone who is wearing a mask, not breaking the law, wearing a mask for their own health.
So this sends the bill to conference committee. How likely do we think it is that they're going to find a compromise and pass something? I'll throw that to Mary C. Curtis.
Well, I don't know. It's another one of these bills that is so vague in a way. I mean, a lot of folks, particularly folks, who are saying there are a lot of potential problems with this because it'll be selective enforcement going up to people. Are you really sick? You know, are you doing this because you are sick? Who is going to get pulled over potentially for committing a crime? Will there be profiling? And also, so much of this seems in reaction to protests that we've seen on college campuses and elsewhere, pro-Palestinian rights protests where folks are wearing masks. And there have been complaints that they're doing that to conceal their identity. So you do have two competing forces. Now, of course, Republicans have the supermajority. They can do what they want. But you do see with the House pulling back a bit that people really are concerned that it is vague when it comes to folks who are, you know, wearing it for their health. And all it takes is someone who really has a health problem. Maybe they're a youthful person, and being told to take a mask off. And then you'll have the arguments back and forth. So I maybe they'll come up with a compromise, but it does seem, again, one of those bills that is going to be so vague as to cause complications in how it is enforced.
Okay, we're going to go to another public health issue. This one surprised me. Alex, you wrote this week about pool rentals, residential pool rentals. And I believe it was the Mecklenburg County Health Department issued a notice this week telling people not to do this, that this is prohibited. I didn't really know that this was a thing. So how did this put this in context for us on how this became a concern for the county?
Yeah, it's become a fast growing trend over the last few years where people can get on an app like Airbnb. There's one called, I think, Swimply, and you can go on there to rent a person's pool like in their backyard for a few hours. And I think that's become more popular since 2021-ish. That's when the state put out guidance and said, this isn't allowed. This would be considered a public pool and you need to have an operating permit and do all the things that public pools must do, like, you know, put up no diving signs and things like that. So while an Airbnb pool is still, if you're staying overnight in an Airbnb, you can still use that pool. It's considered private. This pool that you can get through an app for just like an hour or two is considered, this is considered public, where the Airbnb is private, so they don't have to follow the same guidance. But the county just put out this alert because warmer weather coming up and they want to make sure people aren't taking part in this. And if they do, they'll refer the cases to the state and there might be legal action taken against the homeowner.
I think Eli wants to offer up his pool. Go ahead, Eli.
Yeah, I have a toddler splash table in the backyard. maybe I can get a few bucks an hour for that. But, you know, I think it's interesting that this is very similar to the dynamics we've seen around things like Uber and Lyft and ride sharing, where, you know, it feels like ancient history now. But I remember probably around a decade ago, the city of Charlotte was trying to regulate those ride hailing companies and subject them to the same regulations as, taxi cabs have been subject to. And the companies were able to lobby the General Assembly and, you know, get those regulations basically overridden at the state level, where it's, you know, now they're ubiquitous. So it's the same kind of issues we've seen with those other ride hailing companies and other sharing economy companies. So, you know, I think it would be not surprising if we saw some legislation from Raleigh preempting local regulations in the future Also, you know, you can still go on Swimply. I was just looking, and there's some nice hot tubs for $50 an hour still on there now. So I don't think people are really following this.
Swimply says that they are standing by, that they consider their pools private and they do not have to follow these state regulations. So
I just love saying Swimply. Alex, another story that you covered this week was the city council zoning meeting. And you wrote about this project in the Elizabeth neighborhood. It is 193 residential units on East 7th Street. And I think that council opted to defer it because of height concerns. But tell us a little bit about not just that, but what's going on in Elizabeth, because there seems to be a lot of tension over growth in that neighborhood.
Yeah, Elizabeth is a very interesting place to be right now because you have all these single family homes in this historic, quaint area, but you also have some of the best transit infrastructure in the city, some of the best jobs, location to Central Piedmont Community College. So we're trying to strike this balance between keeping the character of this really nice historic neighborhood and also capitalizing on all these investments. So for over a year now, the Elizabeth Community Association has been working with this developer. They purchased this land across from Cajun and Queen. It's vacant now, just a dirt lot. And they had made this plan where they would have a building that was 78 feet kind of towards the front of 7th Street. And then in the back, it would drop off and it'd be, I believe, 45 feet tall, closer to the single family homes. Once this got to city council, though, city staff said that 78 feet was too tall, 13 feet too tall to be exact, and that they would prefer if they kept it at 65 feet. So that ended up persuading city council to defer the project. It almost got completely rejected, which would have prevented a rezoning for 2 years. But the district representative, Dante Anderson, said that would not be a good idea, that they might end up with a worse product or building in the long run. So they're deferring it, and then we'll just have to see what happens next if the developer is able to come back with a different plan that they might be more agreeable to.
So we have to defer action for just 90 seconds. We have a lot more to discuss here on the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and this is the Local News Roundup. Our panel continues our conversation. We have Mary C. Curtis from RollCall.com, Eli Portillo from WFAE, Alex Sands from Axios Charlotte, and Mary Ramsey of the Charlotte Observer. Let's stay with zoning for another moment. Mary R., on Monday, council also heard a petition from the Carolina Panthers to rezone 12 acres of city-owned property behind Bank of America Stadium. What do the Panthers want to do, and how did council react?
Yes, so the Panthers are looking to build a new training facility. They have already torn down what was dubbed the Bubble, their previous facility, and are looking to put together new indoor and outdoor fields, as well as a viewing platform at the new training facility. The public hearing on the petition was held this week. There was some community pushback mentioned at that hearing. One Third Ward resident spoke, said he and his neighbors have some concerns about the height of the indoor facility and it affecting their skyline views. The representative from the Panthers who spoke at the meeting acknowledged that they've heard some similar feedback at some community meetings that they've had about the project. And council member Malcolm Graham, whose district includes the property, said he has also heard from some residents who have concerns about the height, some traffic impacts, as well as the loss of some longstanding trees. But he said that he is confident that with another community meeting on the books between when the hearing happened and when the final vote will happen, he's confident that everybody will be able to come together and find a deal that they're happy on. And worth noting that city staff also told council that they are in support of the petition.
And we have no word yet on cost, who will pay the cost, and when this will be built, correct?
Yes, those were not specifics that were given at this hearing. They did show some renderings, the Panthers, of what this could look like, but I have not heard anything yet from them in terms of cost.
Eli.
And, you know, there's the neighbors saying that this is an eyesore, but, you know, if you want an eyesore, go down 77 and look at the half-built, abandoned Panthers headquarters and practice facility that was left behind there. So, yeah, I think as long as this one gets finished, it'll be better.
Yeah. And this is a big change for the Panthers because they've always had training camp down at Wofford College in Spartanburg, and now they're coming to Uptown as of this summer, even without the field house, right, Mary?
Yes. Yeah. We've come a long way from the one Carolina moniker that was everywhere for those few years when they were trying to get the South Carolina project off the ground.
Correct. On Thursday, the UNC Board of Governors approved ending diversity, equity, and inclusion programs at 17 schools. That decision reverses a policy put in place in 2019. Only two of the 24 board members opposed ending DEI. UNC Chapel Hill trustees had already taken that step last week when they voted to steer $2.3 million now allocated for DEI to public safety. But UNC System President Peter Hahn said Thursday that the vote violated board policy.
Our legal counsel advised theirs that they don't have the ability to change line items within the university's budget. They chose to disregard that advice.
So, Mary C. Curtis, what are the chances that DEI survives, you think, given what he just said?
Well, it's going to be, a disagreement on this because, of course, this is following so many states throughout the country where there's been an attack on diversity, equity, and inclusion. And UNC, of course, they have this argument, and they also have obligations as a system of public universities that was not inclusive to minorities and others up until really recent times, let's face it, the 50s, late 50s, 60s, 70s. And all of these offices of DEI, some of them weren't called that at the time, but are federally mandated to make sure the university system was an inclusive place for minorities, but also first-generation college students, veterans, the disabled. And UNC has policies in place for this. And also, it's going to make it harder, many say, to recruit students, diverse students, which is North Carolina, faculty who will feel restricted by the policy in what they can teach, because a lot of this also we see in university systems throughout the country, and also they're talking about it at UNC systems on how they can teach about race, racism, gender issues. And so, yeah, this discussion is going to continue. Also, it indeed is vague. I think it comes from a misunderstanding in many cases of what diversity, equity, inclusion, and all of these programs really mean. So, yeah, this is just the beginning. We already saw there were protests by students, you know, faculty, they're pushing back. The UNC administrators are pushing back. But at the same time, as I said, this has become a political issue as well. And people are throwing around the term DEI. And when I think someone on the board was asked, what are these ways of teaching that make people uncomfortable? How has DEI gone too far in this way? And they really couldn't point to examples. So again, you know, an issue that's vague, it will be interpreted by every single person to believe, you know, to interpret it in the way they see fit. And in the meantime, how will this affect the university, the quality of the university, its reputation, and you know, how it is going to serve students, which I think or thought was really the point of it all.
Eli, were you stretching or did you want to say something? I apologize.
Oh, you know, it could be either. I think that, you know, obviously North Carolina is not alone when it comes to this. These are measures that have been taken in a lot of states, and we've seen them certainly spread. You know, here at UNC Charlotte, they've said that they're waiting for guidance still and trying to figure out exactly what will happen, you know, with positions like their chief diversity officer and people who report to it. One thing that's interesting to keep in mind, too, is that this coincides, of course, with the Supreme Court decisions that have eliminated race-conscious admissions policies for students who are applying to get in. So I think that, you know, there's a possibility of some pretty far-reaching changes to how colleges have really approached race and trying to diversify their student bodies for, you know, I think it's fair to say a generation now.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because we're not talking about legacy admissions, folks who have gotten in because their relatives went or who gave a lot of money. I always say the best way to get into Harvard is to have a school, a building named after your family on the campus. They don't talk about, particularly in North Carolina, I don't think you'll hear them talking about how they recruit athletes. And they recruit, all schools recruit for having people from different areas and representation from different states, or in UNC, from different counties. They want to make sure they have folks from all over. So it's a very complicated discussion that I think that so many of our legislators want to make simplistic, but it's really not.
Mary C., let's stay on the topic of education, which you hinted at this earlier. This topic of public school funding and increasing support from state lawmakers for private school vouchers. I want to read you this lead from the News and Observer in Raleigh, because it is quite a statement. Quote, more than 70% of North Carolina families on the waiting list for a taxpayer-funded private school voucher wouldn't have been eligible before lawmakers removed the program's income eligibility limits, end quote. That's 39,000 of 55,000 people seeking those vouchers. Given that statistic and given what we were talking about earlier about public funding, why does this seem to be such a strong winning issue for Republicans, you think?
Well, because I think it goes back, as Eli was saying, you know, all of these issues have a history, and there's been an attack on the public school system. And in southern states, of course, when Brown v. Board, which just had its anniversary, I think the 70th anniversary, which is an interesting time where folks are talking about restricting, you know, inclusiveness.
And Justice Thomas had some interesting comments on that.
Yes, just now. Yeah, when they're pulling back from it. I lost my train of thought talking about Brown v. Board. But we saw at that time so many of the school systems, some even closed public school systems, and they would open up private schools. They were called then segregation academies, and try to get public money for these schools so whites could send their children there and avoid the public schools. And we've seen the continuation of this attack on schools, which now some folks don't even call them public schools. They say like government, you know, academies and things like that, like there's some kind of indoctrination where, you know, everybody can go to our public schools, and the public school systems are saying, listen, rather than spend this money on private vouchers, some for folks who already are paying for their children to go to public private schools, why don't we spend it on more resources for underfunded public schools, make them stronger, childcare, teacher pay, things like that. But you see Republicans saying, everyone should be able to have these. I mean, my parents were not wealthy at all, and they spent money for me to go to parochial schools when I grew up, and they felt that they should, because that was their choice, and they still wanted to pay tax money to support the public schools. But now we're seeing an abandonment of that ideal and saying, well, listen, even folks who are really wealthy need to have an alternative, need to have the choice, but they do have a choice, strong public schools.
So let's stick with Republican politics, but we'll go from North Carolina to South Carolina. Former Governor Nikki Haley made her first public appearance this week since dropping out of the presidential race, a few months removed from labeling Republican rival Donald Trump as, quote, diminished and unhinged. She now says she will vote for Trump. Mary C. Curtis, any surprises from what she said this week?
Not at all. Yes, she called him unhinged, not fit. She called him chaos. Chaos follows him everywhere he goes. But she is a Republican who wants a future in the party. And the Republican Party is the party of Trump. So she appeared, I think it was at a conservative group and a funding group, and said this. So it's to be expected. I think it's interesting, though, even after she dropped out of the race, so many folks in the primaries still were voting for Nikki Haley. Will those folks follow her lead and come back to the party? Will some of them say, you know, I really just can't vote for Trump? And this is all happening, of course, when he's in a courtroom. But, you know, North Carolina, of course, we're getting a lot of Trump. We're going to talk about him coming down here for the race. We have his daughter-in-law from North Carolina, Michael Whatley, heading the Republican National Committee. So the party now is just consolidating behind Donald Trump, no matter what.
Eli?
And, you know, I think we've seen people continuing to vote for maybe, 20% or so continuing to vote for Nikki Haley in a lot of these primaries, even after she's dropped out. And I think there's probably a lot of, concern that they will follow her, as Mary said, at the same time. I think there's also degrees of Trump support. Like we've seen a lot of Republican politicians actually going to the courthouse and in New York and being there for part of the trial and then coming out and making statements about how Trump is being, in their eyes, unfairly targeted, that sort of thing. So, you know, there are higher levels of support than saying, I think he's better than Biden. So I'm going to be watching to see if Nikki Haley kind of moves up the ladder, because I think that will be kind of indicative of whether she comes right back in and maybe, you know, is back in line for cabinet posts or things like that, or is just kind of waiting for 2028.
In my roll call column, I called them Trump mini-me's, all in uniform at the courthouse, when they really should have been in the house, which they delayed that. But, whether they come back or not, we'll see, because we see a lot of the generals, his own vice president, say they're not going to vote for him. But will they make that next step and say, I'm going to vote for Biden, or just say, I'm staying home?
Mary Ramsey.
Yes, I just think it's important to note, when we're talking about Nikki Haley specifically, this isn't the first time that she sort of shifted gears on her opinion of former President Trump. She was very much an anti-Trump Republican during his first run for office when she was governor of South Carolina. She then left her governorship midway through her second term to serve in the Trump administration. Granted, her getting that job had a lot more to do with Donald Trump's relationship with her than Lieutenant Governor Henry McMaster than it did with her. But that being said, that was something she had to juggle during this campaign, framing herself as the anti-Trump candidate while also trying to promote her foreign policy experience, which came during the Trump administration and under former President Trump. So it's something she's had to juggle before and will have to juggle in perpetuity as she continues to try and find any sort of foothold in the Republican Party.
Has promotion to UN ambassador?
She won't be VP. She won't be VP. That's what Trump says now.
I'm just curious, has promotion to UN ambassador ever tilted the governor's race before? Maybe it has. I don't know. Let's stay with Trump, Mary Ramsey. He is coming to the Coca-Cola 600, or we think he's coming to the Coca-Cola 600 on Sunday at Charlotte Motor Speedway. What do we know, and why is he coming?
Yes, he is. Officials within the Trump campaign have confirmed that to McClatchy, and he is expected to attend the race this weekend. A little trivia, he will be the first sitting or former president to attend a race at the Charlotte Motor Speedway, but not the first to attend an event. Bill Clinton attended a Ford Mustang convention at the Speedway in 1994. A little trivia for you there.
That's good trivia. I like it.
Yes, this is not the first time that Trump has gone to a NASCAR event. He was Grand Marshal of the Daytona 500 a few years back. He's also made appearances at football games, UFC events. So I've spoken to a number of people this week for a story I have forthcoming in The Observer previewing this visit about why this is happening. And they said, you know, attending sporting events has been a really common tactic for Trump to get some free media coverage, especially in target states like North Carolina. We've all talked about how crucial this state and specifically the Charlotte area could be for the 2024 presidential election. So not a big surprise that he would make a very public appearance here on a weekend when a lot of eyeballs will be tuned to the Speedway.
Well, there you go. Mary Ramsey will have to have the last word for this week. I also want to thank Alex Sands, Mary C. Curtis, Eli Portillo, and Hunter Sines, who joined us from WSOC. And don't forget, as we're talking about racing, the ACC baseball tournament is in town, and three North Carolina schools are still alive at this moment. For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Have a great Memorial Day weekend.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.